short time in the cells, and then they attempted to pin the charge of terrorism on me. But they didn't go ahead with it, because had we gone to court, we would have had a fantastic opportunity to explain precisely why every decent person in the world, without exception, would support the Palestinian right to resist the Palestinian resistance. So they backed off, but they'll be back again. But it's low-level harassment compared to what people have to suffer. 124 dead Palestinian journalists for standing up for their rights. Really, it's low-grade harassment. Some people who are vulnerable, will be deterred by this. But people like David Miller and many other people who stand up and fight, we always win.
Absolutely. More of the amazing discussion in just a few minutes, but let's hear from the Palestinian foreign minister, Riyad al-Maliki, who has met with his Greek counterpart about aid for the Gaza Strip and how to help the Palestinians in the besieged enclave. Al-Maliki shared his thoughts during a news briefing in Athens alongside Greek Foreign Minister George Garipetridis. Let's have a listen.
For us, this is very important, and therefore we talked about how to stop the invasion into Rafah. We talked about how to bring humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, which is certainly scarce due to the barriers and conditions that Israel places on the entry of such aid, and this aid must enter in large quantities and must enter to all areas, including the northern Gaza Strip. We talked about preventing displacement, regardless of its names, this displacement that aims to expel the Palestinian people from the Gaza Strip abroad. The terrorism and violence of the settlers, which increases its ferocity in the West Bank, is a result of the encouragement they receive from the Israeli government, specifically from some ministers in the Israeli government, who are terrorists in every sense of the word, taking lands, building illegal settlements, attacking villages, burning houses and vehicles, cutting down trees and shooting massively at all innocent civilians.
The Palestinian foreign minister there. Fatima, we heard what the foreign minister had to say. He's been doing the diplomatic rounds. We saw him with the Arab bloc at the UN earlier in the week, and now in Athens. Is it having any impact at all?
Well, Saeed, there is an impact. The extent of that impact, we're yet to see. I would say that something that Mick mentioned earlier is key to focus on here. There are elements that coincide with the Holocaust. And when we look at that, we need to see that there is a voice that is coming from Palestine, and there is sort of a representative that can speak on what's happening from that perspective. In terms of what's happened on October 7th compared to what has been happening since and even prior to October 7th, there needs to be a voice and there needs to be people calling out what terrorism looks like, mm-hmm. be it from the Holocaust then or even this Holocaust now potentially. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we do have this minister going around and having these diplomatic discussions. Whether or not it's going to impact foreign policy, I'm not sure. It's not information that people didn't already know. It's just simply even just having that person there as a representative holds power in itself.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to Mick now. The matter of the Israeli onslaught, Mick, is clearly an international issue. This is becoming less and less limited to only the Gaza Strip. But is it the case that until the chief accomplice, Washington, acts, the rest are just screaming into the void here?
I don't believe it. I think if America decided to stop the genocide, they could do so very quickly indeed. But it doesn't mean that the EU lacks in power. The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. They give Israel sweetheart deals. They give them privileged access to markets. They have very intimate scientific and technical cooperation. And all of this could be used as leverage against Israel if the EU decided to do so. So it's purely a matter of will. Look, Israel is about 6 million Zionist Jews and another million non-Zionist Jews, surrounded by a few hundred million Arabs and other people in the Middle East who know what Israel is doing, that it's a Jewish supremacist state. The only thing that Israel can possibly stop Israel is force. Now, that force can be military, it can be economic internationally, it can be popular, revulsion and political action. But ultimately, unless Israel is stopped by these varieties of resistance, after they deal with the Palestinians successfully through ethnic cleansing, God forbid, then other people in the Middle East will be in their crosshairs. Having created a monster, Britain, and then the USA, aided by the EU, begins to fear this monster. We see ministers in Belgium and in Spain beginning to call for action against Israel. But, you know, it's such a monstrous regime that sometimes if you have a big attack dog, it might bite you. And I think that's a possibility at the moment. But resistance is the only way to save the people of the Middle East from a cataclysm. This is a monstrous regime. If you can kill 500 people in a hospital in one night, and you have 100 atom bombs and hydrogen bombs, this is a danger to the whole world, for sure.
For sure. You speak of resistance. I was watching The Wanted 18 last night. It's a form of resistance that came in the form of buying cows from the Israelis, and how that went for those of our viewers who are interested. They may want to watch that. It is ongoing, of course. It has been going on for decades. But what I would like to ask you is that this is a historic moment, of course, Fatima, that will have future generations asking why we didn't do more. How do you think people who will come after us, the future generations, judge or look upon today's leaders who could have done more, who could have stopped it today, but did not?
Well, we tend to see history repeating itself over and over. The difference is that now, with the avenues of information that we have, the younger generation are seeing live what is happening. So whilst our generation might have learnt about genocides and history lessons or whatnot, it's from a biased perspective still. You need to understand that. When it's being taught to you, mm-hmm. especially in the UK, you're being taught by the colonisers what they did. That is true to an extent for the younger generation now, but they're seeing it more from a social media perspective, which is unbiased, still biased, but less. So they know the truth. They're growing up seeing those people killed in Rafah, in Gaza. They're seeing all of the atrocities live. I mean, it's not the same as previous wars or conflicts where you didn't see the little girls hanging without legs. Yeah. You didn't see all of these atrocities. Our younger people are seeing them. They're seeing the bloodshed. They're seeing the mothers holding their babies wrapped in cloth. And it's terrifying to them. Yeah. So not only are they being traumatized now, this is a trauma they will carry on. Mm-hmm. So when they become adults and when they do become of voting age, they will hold our political leaders to account. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they see, as you say, the lies, the double standards as well. While we're in the UK, as long as the UK government doesn't listen to the voice of its people and demand a ceasefire in Palestine, demonstrations will continue. That, according to the campaigners from the Newcastle Stop the War Coalition, speaking at a recent protest in London against the unfolding genocide in Gaza. Have a listen.
We're here to stop the genocide and try to spread the message about Palestine. Obviously, we're with a group, all of us, and Stop the Campaign. All of us are here from Newcastle, Stop the Campaign, and PSA and FOA are here. They're somewhere around the crowds. We are here for one message, ceasefire. We want a ceasefire in the UK. We want innocent people stop getting killed.
Okay, we're demonstrating for an immediate ceasefire. We're putting pressure on Rishi Sunak and on the British government and demanding that all of our politicians hold Israel to account. And we are holding our politicians to account, demanding that they represent us, that we want peace and justice in Palestine. We keep demonstrating in the hope that it will make an impact on the political decisions that our government makes. But they need to know that they will pay a price, and politicians will pay a price if they don't represent our voices and they don't do what we are saying, which is a very simple demand. It's the bare minimum, which is that there is a ceasefire in Palestine. A huge number of people are very disillusioned with politicians, and people will make their own decisions about how they vote. But the message is, if you don't call for a ceasefire, then you don't deserve our vote.
Meantime, the World Health Organization says a field hospital in Gaza, set up to receive some 200 patients a day, is receiving up to 700, nearly half of them, severe trauma cases. The WHO's Dr. Richard Pieperkorn made the comment while visiting a field hospital set up by the NGO International Medical Corps in Rafah. He expressed concern over an expected ramping up of fighting in the southern Gaza city, which could quickly overwhelm an already severely depleted medical system.
We have seen this, of course, with other hospitals. When military activities come close to a hospital, staff cannot attend the hospital, patients cannot access the hospital, WHO cannot bring in their supplies, and the hospital very quickly becomes partially functional, barely functional, and non-functional. This is one of the hospitals we need, and we need to keep it for a long time.
Let's continue the discussion with my guests, Fatima Merchant and Mick Napier, as we enter the final stretch of the show, and I go to Mick first. Worrying signs, Mick, over there, that even the field hospitals are in danger of being overwhelmed, and we're still not at the worst of things. Can you, based on your experience, of course, of observing these conflicts, draw a picture of how worse things can't really get?
They cannot get much worse. This has been building for a very long time. The Israelis have a hideous expertise in ethnic cleansing. They're born out of ethnic cleansing as a state, and it's never stopped. This comes back to the level of 1948, however, when gangs go into villages, towns, line up the young men and old men and young and boys, and execute them in front of their family in order to instill fear. Numerous examples of this. The Israelis have the world's greatest expertise in this kind of ethnic cleansing. How can it get worse? Just more of the same. I mean, will the Egyptians allow a million people to be pushed over the border into Sinai? Will they fight? Nothing suggests that they will. And if you go to bed with Israel, as the Egyptians have done since the 70s, your options become very limited. The ability to fight atrophies. But people have to fight. Otherwise, I fear this will be Rwanda on steroids. This will be a successful ethnic cleansing. I don't think the outcome is guaranteed. It depends upon the resistance of people across the Middle East. And we are so inspired by the Yemenis, who are enforcing international law to protect people in danger of genocide. And for their pains, they're being bombed by the British and the Americans. This is so clear. You know, Ronald Reagan used the phrase the empire of evil to talk about America's enemies. Yeah. But millions and millions of people around the globe now realize what the empire of evil is. And its capitals are Washington, London, and Brussels.
Correct. And speaking of inspiration, that is shared by millions of people, hundreds of millions of people around the world, and no less the people here in the UK. Weekend protests for months now. There's another national one taking place this week, and as we heard the activists say earlier, that they're not going to stop unless and until the British government changes its position. How do you see that? I haven't lived here for a long time, but I think this level of commitment is really unprecedented.
Absolutely. I think that we've not seen this level of commitment before. I've been organising protests for a long time now, and even I'm shocked seeing that the turnout isn't dwindling. And it's amazing to see that people are willing to come out weekend after weekend after weekend to fight for what they believe is right, for human rights. Yeah. And we are seeing more and more that our government, be it a democracy, doesn't seem to reflect what the people want. And more people are getting frustrated and are willing to come out. So this is something that will escalate. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's something that will quieten down with our government's silence. I think that the more silent they are and the more complicit the UK becomes, the more the people will stand up. So when you are going to protest, I would say to any viewers listening that you are having a direct impact. Mm-hmm. You may feel as though it's something that you're just going to be doing every weekend you know, and it doesn't really make a difference whether or not you show up yourself, but it does. It makes a massive difference.
Exactly. It's that knowledge that keeps galvanizing people to turn out weekend after weekend. Final question to Mick, and briefly, if you may, Mick. Palestine is now a political issue, and with the ceasefire vote looming in the British Parliament, talk about the significance of this vote and the message the outcome of it will send.
It's very difficult to tell because we have a pro-genocide government and a pro-genocide opposition. I think, come the next election, we'll be able to vote UK-wide for two parties, each of which supports the Israeli genocide. That's clear. I don't think demonstrating, as we do every week and as we will do in Glasgow tomorrow in a Scottish demonstration, is enough. We defeated the American militarists in Vietnam because they began to be afraid of a mass movement getting out of control. In Glasgow last week, this week, we saw an arms company shut down for a day. We've seen students occupy buildings. We need to go beyond an electoral focus in order to create the conditions where the government realises it will be more dangerous to continue supporting genocide than to retreat.
Okay, and that does it for this episode. Fatima Merchant and Mick Napier, thank you for your time, and thank you. Join us again next time for more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Reports say that many patients have died at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip because of an Israeli raid that has cut off electricity supply to the hospital. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Medical authorities in the Gaza Strip say at least four patients have lost their lives at a hospital in southern part of the territory because power to the facility was cut off during an Israeli raid and oxygen supplies were subsequently restricted at the hospital. The generators of Nasser Hospital stopped functioning and the power was cut off to the hospital, Gaza's health ministry said in a statement on Friday, 16th of February, raising the alarm over the fate of six other patients in an intensive care unit and three children in a nursery at the medical complex in the southern city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. We hold the Israeli occupation forces responsible for the lives of patients and staff at the hospital, considering that the medical complex is now under the full control of the Israeli army, the statement added. Additionally, reports indicate that two women have been forced to give birth in inhumane conditions at Nasser Hospital, without electricity, water, food, or heating. Dr. Nahed Abu Taima, director of Nasser Medical Complex, has described the situation at the hospital as catastrophic. We were forced to transfer all the patients and the wounded to the hospital's old building, he told Al Jazeera television network on Friday, 16th of February, adding that Israeli forces were rounding up patients and civilians taking shelter in the hospital. Electrical power has been cut off from the entire medical complex. Many patients in intensive care units and those on oxygen supply and also those on dialysis machines are left fighting for their lives. Since 3 a.m., Dr. Nahed Abu Taima emphasized. He added, "We stand helpless, unable to provide any form of medical assistance to the patients inside the hospital or the victims flooding into the hospital every single minute." Earlier, the health ministry in Gaza warned that the imminent depletion of fuel and the Israeli blockade posed a threat to the lives of patients and vulnerable children at the medical complex. It also appealed to all international institutions to intervene quickly to save patients and staff at the Nasser Medical Complex before it was too late. Meanwhile, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, has refused to grant South Africa's request for the tribunal to impose urgent measures aimed at safeguarding the city of Rafah in southern Gaza Strip, which faces the imminent threat of an Israeli ground invasion. Known as the World Court, the International Court of Justice said in a statement on Friday, 16th of February, that the perilous situation in Rafah demands immediate and effective implementation of the provisional measures that it had ordered back on 26th of January. It said no new order was necessary because the existing measures are applicable throughout the Gaza Strip, including in Rafah. The court added the Israeli regime remains bound to fully comply with its obligations under the Genocide Convention, and the 26th of January ruling, which ordered the Israeli regime to do all it can to prevent death, destruction, and any acts of genocide in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime has been waging a war against Gaza since 7th of October last year, following an operation staged by Gaza's resistance groups dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Storm. The war has so far killed around 28,800 Palestinians, many of them women and children. Also, the foreign ministers of the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia have discussed regional and international issues of concern, most notably the recent developments in the city of Rafah in southern Gaza Strip and the humanitarian situation in Gaza. In a telephone conversation on Friday, 16th of February, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and the Saudi foreign minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud stressed the need to develop a strategic direction in mutual relations given the ongoing regional and international developments and problems facing the Muslim world, particularly the issue of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the Israeli regime continues its crimes against Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank and its moves in Rafah, and called for efforts to counter the Israeli regime's threats against the population of Gaza, particularly in Rafah. The United States is complicit in the developments in Gaza and in the West Bank and has given the Israeli regime the green light to conduct ground invasion of Rafah, Amir Abdollahian added. He emphasized that Iran does not believe that war could be a solution to the Palestinian issue. The Iranian foreign minister warned that if the conflict is not solved immediately through political channels, the continuation of Israel's genocide will have inevitable adverse consequences on regional security and regional stability. Hossein Amir Abdollahian called for an emergency meeting of the Council of Foreign Ministers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, to discuss the current crisis in Gaza. The humanitarian crisis in Gaza is deteriorating at an alarming rate as the Israeli regime keeps pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the besieged territory. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Israeli army has raided the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip that is still functioning amid warnings from the United Nations aid chief that that a threatened ground invasion of Rafah, the area's last remaining place of relative safety, could trigger an exodus of Palestinian refugees fleeing into Egypt. The Nasser Hospital in the central town of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip was hit directly by tank fire overnight. Staff at the medical complex confirmed on Thursday, 15th of February, in an attack that killed one person and injured eight others. Dr. Khaled Al-Sir, a surgeon at the Nasser Hospital, said in an Instagram post that the Israeli army ground troops stormed the premises about an hour later and began forcing patients, medical personnel and displaced civilians sheltering at the hospital. All those sheltering at the hospital began to flee. Videos posted by Dr. Khaled Al-Sir, a surgeon at Nasser Hospital, and by others who said they were at the medical complex showed dripping water mixed with blood on the floor of the hospital and dust and smoke filling the air as people searched for survivors under the rubble using lights on their phones. Shooting could be heard in the background. The United Nations Humanitarian Office had said on Wednesday that Nasser Hospital had been besieged by the Israeli army, with allegations that sniper fire had been aimed at the medical facility. Meanwhile, Egypt has begun building an enclosed area ringed with high concrete walls along its border with the Gaza Strip that appears intended to house Palestinians fleeing a threatened Israeli invasion and assault on the southern city of Rafah in the Gaza Strip. Photographs and videos released by the Sinai Foundation for Human Rights, a monitoring group, shows workers using heavy machinery erecting concrete barriers and security towers around a strip of land on the Egyptian side of the border with Rafah. The video, dated 15th of February, gave little indication of the authorities installing water or other infrastructure at the site. Satellite imagery released by Planet Laboratories on the same day shows cleared strips of land adjacent to Egypt's border with Gaza.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program we talk about different teachings of the Holy Quran about the human being, different dimensions, and like the dual nature of the human being, the physical and the spiritual aspect. We talked about it, and we talked about different faculties and dimensions of the soul, the spiritual aspect of the human being. In the previous episodes, we talked about, we had a rather long discussion about different dimensions and qualities and conditions of the heart. We had interesting discussions about the emotions, the epistemological function of the heart, and the responsibility of the heart. And I think this is time for us to start another dimension of the soul, which is intellect in the Holy Quran. And this is very important discussion, the discussion of reason, al-aql, the concept of aql in the Holy Quran. As some people believe, aql is the most important thing that separates us human beings from animals. And so when we talk about humanity, we should also talk about the aql, reason and intellect and see what Quran, the Holy Quran, has to say about human intellect in the in different verses. So this is interesting to know that aql in the Holy Quran is sometimes has sometimes been put as the opposite of jahl. Now, jahl is sometimes translated as ignorance, but we should know that jahl in Arabic is also the opposite of aql, reason. So we can say jahl means foolishness. And the reason for this might be that a foolish person, the behavior and actions of a fool person is very much like the behavior and action of a person who doesn't know anything. Sometimes ignorance results in the same behavior than stupidity. So, but the two are different. One of them is lacking knowledge, the other is lacking a faculty of thinking. So this is important because in Arabic there is a saying, "Ta'raful ashya bi athdadiha." When you want to know something, you want to see, you need to see what is the opposite of that thing. So when we want to see what aql is, you should see what jahl is. And to follow or to trace the concept of jahl in the Holy Quran. Also, another opposite of aql in the verses of the Holy Quran is safah. Safah means foolishness. Now, we have verses of the Holy Quran talking about this foolishness, and we go through some of them. So, safih, or a person, a fool person, a stupid person, according to the verses of Quran, sometimes a person who doesn't know the value of things. This is very important. Now, it's not all kinds of craziness or lacking intellect or insanity. No, safi is a kind of insanity, lacking reason, that is specifically about a person who does not know the value of things. We will have a break and we come back and I will try to explain it through an example.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. So we were talking about the concept of safah in the Holy Quran because we were trying to understand aql, reason. We said that the opposite of reason is foolishness in some verses of the Holy Quran. So through understanding the opposite, we try to understand the main concept, which is aql. So we said that one specific definition, one specific notion of safah is when a person does not know the value of things. Now, this verse is, وَلَا تُسُفَهَا أَمْوَالَكُمْ. Do not give your money to people who don't, who are safi, who are foolish. And this is a technical, there is a technical definition in jurisprudence for safi, for a stupid person. It's not all sorts of lacking reason. The example of a person who does not, who is safi, who is foolish, is a person, for example, if I give you a certain amount of money, for example, $10. And with the $10, if you know that this $10 is equal to that snack, okay, so you will not be fooled into a wrong deal. You can manage yourself in the market. But then if I give you $1,000 and then you go to the market, or let's assume there's a kid, for example, the child doesn't know the value of $1,000 and he goes there into the market, for example, grocery store, and then the person there says, okay, let me give you this snack and give me this, I don't know, papers. What's the use of these papers? But this is a snack. This is delicious. And the kid says, yes, this is a good deal. So you see, this is called the person, the kid is not stupid in the way that we consider stupid, but safah in the technical sense applies to that person, the person who does not know the value of things. Quran says those who commit sins, those who make a very bad deal, they are safih. They don't know the value of things. They think they are selling their soul to dunya, to this life, to the pleasures of this life. And they, in return, they will have a big loss. They lose akhira. They lose the eternal life. See, listen to this beautiful verse. وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ آمِنُوا كَمَا آمَنَ النَّاسِ. When they are told, believe, have faith, like the way people have faith. قَالُوا أَنُؤْمِنُ كَمَا آمَنَ السُّفَهَا. You see, this debate is as old as history, that atheists try to say you are the smartest people. We don't believe because you are smart. And nowadays you can see that. They take pride in the atheism because they think, okay, faith and these ideological systems, religions, they belong to the stupid people, and we are the smart, we are the educated, and that's why we don't believe. So Quran says, no, this is not something new. This existed throughout history. When they were told, believe like the way people have believed, they say, أَنُؤْمِنُ كَمَا آمَنَ السُّفَهَا. Should we believe like the way that the stupid and the foolish have believed? كَمَا آمَنَ السُّفَهَا. Quran says, أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ السُّفَهَا. Know that they are stupid in reality. The foolish are those who think that there is only one understanding, and they don't even give the possibility and probability of an eternal life. This should be very concerning, that if there is an eternal life and you don't secure that, you don't guarantee that with a very easy step, then you will be in big loss. So we will talk about this fight over who is stupid and who is the smart choice, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, in the next episode, inshallah. Thank you very much for listening. And until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
As the Israeli killing machine continues to wreak havoc in the besieged Gaza Strip, arms manufacturers in the United States are making merry, expecting a big boost to their profits. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website Wire News has covered this story and tells us more. The US arms manufacturer Lockheed Martin has ramped up its production to reap more and more profits as demand increases. The company, which produces military aerospace, arms, defence, information security and technology, announced on Thursday, 15th of February, that it aims to ramp up production of essential weapon systems to meet growing global demand for arms and munitions, including the production of its high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, Javelin missiles, and GMLRS and PAC-3 systems. Lockheed Martin's Chief Operating Officer, Frank St. John, said on its website, Lockheed Martin remains committed to ramping production of high-demand systems like HIMARS, Javelin, GMLRS, PAC-3, and more. He added, in 2024, we are on track to double HIMARS production, have increased Javelin's production to 2,400 units per year, and will deliver more than 10,000 GMLRS. Frank St. John claimed, OneLMX, a digital transformation initiative that integrates cutting-edge solutions, leveraging decades of historical data, analytics, and advanced artificial intelligence to augment our workforce and increase productivity levels, have propelled our ramp-up progress. He said, we're deploying automation, robotics, and factory simulations and investing in long-lead procurement to cut missile production times, increase capacity, and maintain manufacturing excellence. Through digital transformation, Lockheed Martin is not just meeting significantly increased demand at this critical geopolitical point, but leading the defense industry into the future, ensuring we continue to deliver innovative, affordable 21st century security solutions to our customers. Production capacity has already seen a notable rise, with an increase from 48 units annually to 60 units, and projections suggest reaching an impressive capacity of 96 units by the conclusion of 2024. Furthermore, Lockheed Martin increased production of the Javelin system, a highly versatile anti-tank missile system vital for ground operations. Presently, production has escalated to 2,400 units per year, with plans underway to bolster this capacity to 3,960 Javelin system units annually by late 2026. In addition to HIMARS and Javelin, Lockheed Martin aims to deliver over 10,000 guided multiple launch rocket systems, GMLRS, this year alone. Meantime, observers link the increased demand for weapons and munitions to the US-led proxy war in Ukraine against Russia and the months-long Israeli war in West Asia and America's escalating tensions with China. The website of Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. As the Israeli killing machine continues to wreak havoc in the besieged Gaza Strip, arms manufacturers in the United States are making merry, expecting a big boost to their profits. The United States has vowed unconditional and unwavering support to the Israeli regime in its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. One of the means of support is the supply of lethal weapons to the Tel Aviv regime, which has spread cheer on Wall Street and arms companies alike, looking for ways to maximize their profits from the war in Gaza. According to a report published by The Guardian and Responsible Statecraft, major military firms in the United States are eyeing big gains from the war and the Israeli regime has imposed on the Palestinian people. After the Israeli regime launched its bombing campaign on Gaza on 7th of October last year, stock prices of major American and European arms manufacturers have seen substantial increases. The Israeli war on Gaza has significantly depleted the military arsenal of many countries. The refilling of these stockpiles means huge new orders of arms funded by Washington and supplied by Wall Street arms corporations. Major U.S. weapons manufacturers such as Lockheed Martin, RTX, formerly known as Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and the General Dynamics have been singled out in a report by Eyes Under Ties. According to the report, these firms collectively reported $196.5 billion in military-related revenues in 2022. All five arms corporations have a history of providing weapons to the Israeli regime for use against Palestinians and have recently been linked to weapons sales during the current conflict in Gaza. The news outlet noted, "The top shareholders in these five defense companies largely consist of big asset managers or big banks with asset management wings that include BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity, Capital Group, Wellington, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Newport Trust Company, Longview Asset Management, Massachusetts Finance Services Company, Good Capital, and Path of America."
I'm Fatah Masumi, and this is Simorgh, a special edition dedicated to the 42nd Fajr International Film Festival, a festival that stands out because of the number of animations that were screened.
This year, four feature-length animation movies entered the competition. Sheep Hero by Hossein Safarzadegan won the Crystal Seymour, a very recent recognition as the best animation category was officially added to the award list of the Fajr International Film Festival only 6 years ago, in 2019. And that year, in the 37th edition of the festival, the first ever Crystal Seymour was awarded to a feature-length animation movie, The Last Fiction by Ashkan Rahgozar receiving the honor. And this was all thanks to eight movies that were submitted to the Secretariat of the Festival 4 years earlier, drawing attention to this new form of artistic expression, gaining a foothold in the industry, with the one called The Return by Mohammad Amin Hamedani gaining recognition. All this can be traced back to the first animation that entered the festival, Jamshid and Khorshid by Alireza Yaghmaiyan, an animation movie that made history in 2005 when it appeared on the shortlist of the movies of the festival.
You may be thinking that the Fajr Film Festival is exclusive to filmmakers, critics, and journalists, but no, public screenings are available for ordinary people who line up to watch the movies.
The Fajr International Film Festival is famous for its public screenings, and during the second week of this major cultural event, 56 movie theaters in different provinces across the country also hosted the Fajr Film Festival, with people lining up, and according to schedule, the films of the festival were screened, drawing cinema enthusiasts to the movie theaters for a full week. And that is why the Fajr International Film Festival, Iran's most prestigious cinematic event, is often referred to as a national celebration of the art of cinema.
Qatar Ghazali Cinema Town is the biggest cinema set in Iran, where the most iconic historical movies have been filmed. Could you think of a better place for foreign filmmakers to visit? Well, the guests of the Fajr Film Festival did exactly that.
Spending half a day in Iran's biggest and most prominent movie set turned out to be a unique experience for the foreign guests of the Fajr International Film Festival.
My name is Nihal and I've come here from Pakistan. It's my first time in Iran. I'm really honored to be participating in Fajr Film Festival. I could never have thought that I'll be able to visit Iran if it were not for this festival. I'm really happy to have visited the media town where there are film studios. I'm amazed to know that around 100 or more than 100 feature films are made in Iran every year. This has really inspired me to watch Iranian films. Many years ago when I was little, I watched Children of Heaven, in which there were child actors. I really liked that film. And in Pakistan, it's very difficult for us to watch Iranian films. We don't know much about these films, but we know that Iranian culture is rich with ideas, philosophy, and literature. So I'd like to go home and watch more Iranian films on YouTube. I was here to explore how I can link young filmmakers in Pakistan with opportunities in Iran, maybe do some co-production and discuss some possibilities about exchanging content. A lot of young filmmakers in Pakistan are struggling to have their work marketed in other countries. I was really happy to have visited all the stalls in the film market and explore some possibilities for connecting young filmmakers between the two countries.
Located on the outskirts of the Iranian capital, Tehran, with an area of about 115,000 square meters, Ghazali Cinema Town, as it is commonly referred to, was built over four decades ago. Back then, the movie set was designed for the filming of the epic historical drama TV series directed by Ali Hotami called Hazar Dastan, one of the most important and most influential works of art in the history of Iran's broadcasting.
I'm from Bangladesh. I'm a festival director of the Dhaka International Film Festival. This is my 30 years. I'm coming to this festival. First, I've been here in 1994, and this is 2024. It's 30 years. It's my 17th time. I've been many times in Iran, and many films I have screened in my festival. And also, I'm very happy that I know many types of filmmaker and actor, actress from Iran who has visited our festival. And we have a very good partnership with the Iranian films and our audience. Our audience definitely like the Iranian films. Without Iranian films, we cannot have the festival. So this is one of the major things, I mean, what we have Iranian segment. This year we had a master class. Majid Majidi was in Dhaka and he had a master class in Dhaka. It was very successful and I'm really looking forward in future we'll do more better. I'm a jury of the Eastern Vista, the Asian section jury. We have 11 films. We have still need to watch, then finally we can say. We are watching and we have a very good numbers of films is there. So inshallah, we'll come decided very soon. I mean, which one is the best and which one is got the award. And overall, I'm sure pretty good collection selection is there. So many international delegates is there. So it's very nice. Good. Everything is okay. Perfect. This Film City I've been at least four times before in my life. First in 1994, I was there. First time. Later, I visited three times at least.
So what is your impression of this?
It's beautiful. Like, I can't think about it. And Bangladesh, we cannot think about it. But definitely, it's like a role model. If my government give me a support, if they want me, then I will bring them here, come and see these things and try to build in our country.
Throughout the years, the locations that have been replicated here include iconic cities of the pre-Islamic and post-Islamic era. But probably the most favorite part is Tehran during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, before, during, and after World War II. This part of the movie set has been used numerous times for the filming of big-budget movies and TV series.
My name is Caroline Marconi, and I am from Zimbabwe in Africa.
And how many times have you come to Iran or the Fajr Film Festival?
Well, I've been here before. I've stayed here for like close to 10 years because my father used to work here. Mm-hmm. But now I've come for the first time attending the Fajr Film Festival, and it feels great.
So what is your position in attending the festival? Like, were you a jury or guest?
Oh, I'm a guest at the festival for now.
And how did you see the movies?
I think the movies are so good. The selection was really, really good. And there's a big variety of genres and like themes and all that. So I've really enjoyed my time here.
Did you just watch the international section or the Iranian movies?
No, also the Iranian movies. Uh-huh. I love those ones as well.
Okay, can you like name one or two from the Iranian or the international section?
Okay. This is the whole thing. There's one about a tree. I think it was some series of a tree or something like that. I thought that was really good. And then the one from Bangladesh as well was really good, but I forgot what
it's called. Bangladesh was, I think...
Something about it.
Yes, exactly.
But it was a very good film. I've actually met
Mr.
one of the...
Mr. Zamzam was the director.
Exactly. So good. It was such a good film. I loved it. And then from the Iranian ones, I can't really say the words anymore, but like really good films as usual. Love them.
Good. And also, how did you find the experience here? Like, we've started touring first, but it's the Azadi Cinema Town. So what do you say about it?
I think it's very good. It is such a very, very big place. I didn't think it would be that big. I think because it's different from my country, I'm quite impressed. We've just seen one of the workshops where they work on the attires and the costume designing. Mm-hmm. I thought that was amazing. They have like, it's a whole business going on here, an entire industry. It's so impressive. I love it.
In the workshops here, everything set and costume designers might need is made from scratch. And currently, another big-budget production is keeping everyone busy. A 60-episode TV series depicting the life of Salman al-Farsi, a Persian religious scholar and one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
My name is Yulia. I represent Russia here. This is my first time in Iran and first time at the Fajr Film Festival. I'm so excited to be here. I'm having a great experience meeting Iranian producers, Iranian filmmakers, and I see a lot of potential for our countries to collaborate. So we are spending this time getting to know each other, finding ways for building stronger relationships. So I hope that after this film festival and this wonderful film market, which I very much appreciate for having me, that we're going to have a very strong collaboration for the next upcoming years.
A través de los vídeos que han mostrado.
Based on the information we got from the videos, I understand that many films and television series have been made here. So I conclude that there are many possibilities to make different films. The fact that you see all this in a country that is not considered Western makes it even more impressive. I think there is a lot of potential, and I am hopeful about the future cooperation, you know?
I'm so impressed of what I see here. I think there are a lot of possibilities for coming and filming here at the studio and just at the Tehran itself. And I'm sure that outside of Tehran there are multiple amazing places that I would love to explore.
I am very impressed by what I see here. There's a lot happening. Judging what I have seen so far, I am sure that great movies and television series have been filmed here. I'm excited to find out what projects are underway.
Currently, currently owned by Iran's national television, IRIB, Ghazali Cinematown offers great opportunities for joint movie projects, and therefore the foreign participants of the Fajr International Film Festival, who are all